Thomas Sugrue est l'un des spécialistes américains les plus reconnus de la question des relations raciales, des droits civiques et de l'histoire urbaine des inégalités, avec bien sûr son livre « The Origins of the Urban Crisis, Race and Inequality in Postwar Detroit ». Et voilà, je lui laisse la parole maintenant.
Thank you, Laurence, for the introduction, and also thanks to you and to Andrew Diamond for inviting me here, and to Sylvie Tissot, Mary Petillo, and Donna Murch for writing such excellent and provocative papers. At a recent workshop that I attended at Princeton University in the U.S., Daniel Rogers, one of the most important historians of transnational social policy, and most recently of the politics and culture of the post-1960s era, cautioned me and other historians against the use of the term neoliberalism, which he argued that across academia we often use uncritically and unreflexively. Rogers is right to a degree. At its simplest, neoliberalism has become, at least in the American academy, a handy stand-in for politics that we don't like. Scholars in cultural studies in particular exemplify the use of neoliberalism as a reductionist explanation of diverse political and social phenomenon, an economic phenomenon. Neoliberalism is sort of an empty signifier that might mean conservatism, austerity, anti-statism, or a new repressive statism, including the powerful carceral state. American policy toward Palestine is neoliberal. Police brutality in Ferguson is neoliberal. Libertarian economics is neoliberal. Rand Paul represents one version of neoliberalism. Oprah, still another version of neoliberalism. Barack Obama is a neoliberal. Ronald Reagan is a neoliberal. Richard Daley is a neoliberal, etc. Neoliberalism might mean privatization. It might mean public-private partnerships, or it might mean the strengthening of an oligarchic control over the state. All of these versions of neoliberalism, I think, suggest that Dan Rogers is at least in part right. Neoliberalism at once explains too much and at the same time too little. But if Rogers is right in criticizing the looseness and lack of specificity of the term neoliberalism, he's wrong, I think, in suggesting that we jettison the term altogether. I would argue instead that it's up to historians and historically engaged social scientists to offer a better, more grounded definition of neoliberalism, to embed it in time, to give it a chronology, to locate it in place. In other words, to give neoliberalism a history. Giving neoliberalism a history also opens up the possibility of advancing social scientific scholarship and theory on neoliberalism and providing, I think, a better framework for anti-neoliberal activists. At the core of much of the good work on neoliberalism, the important scholarship on neoliberalism are historical assumptions. Assumptions about the origins and trajectory of neoliberalism. The most influential scholarship on neoliberalism, following the path-breaking work of David Harvey, dates the neoliberal turn to the early 1970s. It highlights the collapse of Fordism and the decline of trade union power, the death of Bretton Woods, the fallout of the oil shocks and stagflation, and the rise of a political economy that prioritized austerity and facilitated the collapse of a welfare state. In this view, neoliberalism stands in sharp contrast with the era of social democracy, whether it be in the form of America's New Deal or post-war state socialism in Europe. In this chronology of neoliberalism, 1973-74 is the pivot, the great turning point, the moment when everything changed, the moment when we usher in the age of neoliberalism. But this perspective, too, I think is too narrow. It doesn't really allow us to understand the specificity of neoliberalism, or maybe we might use the plural neoliberalisms. By contrast, all three of these papers open up new ways of historicizing and contextualizing neoliberalism. Each of these papers, to one degree or another, offers a working definition of neoliberalism with some historic specificity. All of them, in their own way, challenge the simple pre-1973, post-1973 chronology. And all of them have completely left behind all the simplistic ways that activists and some scholars use neoliberalism as a stand-in for everything. Each of these papers turns our attention toward grassroots actors, toward everyday citizens who are responsible for shaping neoliberalism, who are shaped by neoliberalism, and on occasion, particularly in Donna's paper, who challenge neoliberalism. Also, each of these papers situates neoliberalism in place, understanding it as a process of community formation, of identity creation, of economics and politics. And those places are, of course, gentrifying Boston, or conserving Chicago, or war on drugs, Los Angeles. The actors in each of these papers are not the usual ones in our intellectual histories of neoliberalism. They're not right-wing economists or Austerian politicians or downtown developers. Instead, they're the well-intentioned. That is, in Boston, neoliberalism is given birth to white pioneers, and we'll come back and talk about that language in a minute, who are committed to the principle of racial diversity and who are steeped in the 1960s politics of citizen participation. In Chicago, neoliberalism is the product of post-war efforts to conserve neighborhoods, a project that shifts from racial cleansing to an ostensibly colorblind effort to create socioeconomic stability. In Los Angeles, the agents of neoliberalism include the police and politicians, but also anti-crime African-American community organizations in the 1980s and 1990s who play their own part in the war on gangs. In each of these papers, we see, in other words, a couple of major patterns that are for the most part absent from the canonical scholarly literature on neoliberalism. First, they show that, they show that the neoliberal project is inherently a racial project. Or to put it differently, neoliberalism bridges the politics of racial identity and interest, of economics and identity, of race and class, of black and white, of progressive and conservatism. In other words, they break down the binaries that so shape our understanding of these issues. Next, and this is another way of saying what I said a minute ago, all of them show that neoliberalism is not a top-down phenomenon solely or primarily. Neoliberalism was made by policymakers and corporate elites, but it was also facilitated by grassroots community action. The bottom-up history of neoliberalism is one of the most profound insights in these three papers, and it challenges romantic views of community and grassroots participation, of community formation, of community organizing, of community empowerment. Or maybe in the French context, we shouldn't say community, since that's such a laden term with communitarianism, but maybe substitute a more neutral word like neighborhood. So neighborhood organizing, neighborhood and participation, neighborhood empowerment, neighborhood formation. This in some ways is the center of this paper, which is neoliberalism is bound up with neighborhood and place on the micro level as well as on the macro political level. Also, each of these papers complicates our chronologies of neoliberalism. Tissot sees neoliberalism rooted in the social and political movements of the 1960s. A really great insight, in my opinion, as someone who's been teaching the history of the 60s for most of my career. Petillo goes back further to the post-war years, even to the New Deal, and particularly on the conservation movement of the 1950s and beyond. Murch's story focuses mostly on the post-1970s period, but also moves back to Black Power and to what's happening in an earlier period. So with that big picture in mind, I want to talk just really quickly about some of the insights of each of these papers in turn. Petillo's paper begins a history of neoliberalism the earliest, with the efforts of neighborhood associations and federal policymakers to restrict the racial composition of the housing market. This is, for historians, a familiar story, but she spins it differently from the way that most historians spin it. She sees efforts to preserve racial homogeneity, to marginalize housing for the poor, as in some ways a prehistory of neoliberalism or a pre-neoliberalism. Liberalism, in other words, contains within it, in her view, the seeds of neoliberalism. Well, this is too loose a definition of neoliberalism, I think, is an open question, and I'll return to it briefly in a minute. But I want to focus on the heart of her paper, which is this really rich history of conservation efforts in North Kenwood and Oakland, and the three successive generations of neighborhood planning, first explicit racial exclusion, then by policies that denied racist intention but led to racially disparate results, and a third that foregrounded socioeconomic issues and homogeneity and conservation. And what's interesting about this paper is that Patillo shows that neighborhood conservation planners, and neighborhood conservation, like neoliberalism, is a term that people read really differently. The Black Power people liked it. The University of Chicago liked it. The neighborhood real estate developers liked it. Everyone seemed to like it in some ways. It seemed to speak to all of them in different ways. But the advocates of diversity and integration liked it. But what she shows, I think, quite powerfully is that in this critical period of conservation, activists and planners replaced explicit racial exclusions with calls for ostensibly race-neutral or colorblind ideas like stability and socioeconomic homogeneity that nonetheless were very effective in marginalizing people of color and displacing the poor. What's most interesting here in some ways is that she shows the ways in which conservationists use the tools of planning, including eminent domain, demolition, zoning powers, displacement of public housing residents, all as a way of attempting to transform the neighborhood in ways that kind of, I'll talk about Boston in a minute, but in ways that echo in some ways Sylvie Tissot's discussion of Boston. One of Patillo's most powerful arguments is showing how notions of the good neighborhood really inform this neoliberal project. Hyde Park, Chicago, would tolerate good residents defined by their socioeconomic status, but not, say, those who required social housing. But one of the fundamental questions I'm left with in reading this paper is what the line is between liberalism and neoliberalism. New Deal programs, for all of their flaws, did grow out of a moment of intensive political organization of a broad vision of social democracy, even if it was fundamentally flawed by racial exclusion. At the same time, public housing was an attempt to deal with market failures, even if it played the role of marginalizing the poor and especially of African Americans as it grew more segregated. And so one of the questions that we need to think about is, if public housing was an early version of neoliberalism, why did the neoliberals in the 1980s and 1990s put so much energy into getting rid of it? In other words, there is a tension between these two visions of liberalism and neoliberalism around what the public is, of who the public is, and what the public should be doing. And I'd like to see that articulated a little bit more. But at the core of Patillo's story, though, I think is a really critical insight, which is that neoliberalism is about the struggle for the control of territory and of space, or that spatial politics is constitutive of neoliberalism. And those will come up, I think, in the other two papers as well. And that leads me to, I'm going a little out of order in terms of their presentation, Sylvie Tissot's paper, which I see in some ways as a partner with Mary Patillo's paper. And this is a story that focuses on a narrower period, mostly from the mid-1960s to the mid-1970s, although I know it's a part of a bigger project that comes all the way up to the present, and she alludes to that in her overview. Here, she explores the process of neighborhood planning, but with a different group of residents and activists at the center. Hers are the gentrifiers, the Victorian criminals, the white professionals attracted to the city's historic row houses, repelled by what they see as the blandness, the conformity, the homogeneity of suburbia, and creating a common identity based on values and lifestyle, two terms that seem to be sort of neutral and descriptive, but were actually laden with meaning. At the core of this project is, I think, quite a brilliant insight, drawing from, surprisingly to me, but actually I think even more brilliantly, from E.P. Thompson and about class formation. She looks at the ways in which the upper class who are, is settling and gentrifying Boston creates a common identity, one that's fundamentally intertwined with their economic status, but which is also about a culture that's performed through the valuation of toleration, of multiculturalism, of diversity. She shows, though, that toleration and diversity are problematic concepts. The white gentrifiers in the South End were deeply fearful of racial heterogeneity and of outsiders. They wanted mixed public spaces, but where behavior was strictly policed and without the disquieting presence of the poor and working class, who challenged their sense of who they are or of their lifestyle. They're noisy. They don't keep up their buildings. They spend time outside when we're supposed to be inside, etc. These residents, these gentrifiers, created their sense of identity discursively. And this is also an interesting aspect of this paper. They call themselves pioneers. What an interesting and loaded word, right? Particularly in the post-colonial moment. They talk about an urban renaissance, and they define their goals as transformation. Even though Tissot doesn't use this language, these gentrifiers are kind of colonizers. They're attempting to civilize a territory and to regulate and to control the indigenous population, or maybe like some colonizers, maybe in certain places to displace them altogether. Tissot is especially interested in the dynamic relationship of race and class in this neighborhood, and she shows how the South End gentrifiers create class not just discursively, but by creating institutions. Institutions like the Historical Society, which is ostensibly involved in preserving historic properties, but becomes a way of them redefining the architecture and space of their neighborhood. She shows that they create activism through attempts to regulate public space. They also do it by attending gallery openings and walking their dogs in a park that they created, an interesting story about the reappropriation of public space for their lifestyle. Finally, this is a paper that makes a really important intervention that neoliberalism isn't solely or primarily a state project, but is a result of this mobilization, mobilization against demolition, historic calling for historic preservation, of community organizing against so-called nuisance bars. In this view, neoliberalism identity, aesthetics, and economic interest in the form of property value are all connected and entangled in really interesting ways. But this is ultimately a neoliberalism of class power and social control. Even if the forms of regulation in her story are subtle, while I think this emphasis on subtle forms of regulation and control are really important, I would like to see more, and maybe it's part of the bigger project, of the ways in which policing also created the post-1960s South End, how residents of places like the South End supported the intensification of policing and the rise of the carceral state. Liberal South Enders may have found the question of state power distasteful as good 60s types, but they also flocked to meetings to demand better police patrols, quicker response times, the regulation of noise and other activity on the streets that they found unsettling. And I think there's a really important story to be told. And after all, it's neighborhoods, it's gentrifying neighborhoods like the South End. I think of Greenwich Village in New York, right, that produces Ed Koch and produces a version of get tough on crime policing politics in the 1970s. And 1980s and beyond. And so I think those connections are ones that we can flesh out a little bit more. These folks might be liberal, but they also really care about not getting mugged or of regulating activity on the streets in front of their houses and of creating a neighborhood that reflects their desire for a comfortable, homogeneous, yet diverse lifestyle. And so I want to see a little bit more. That leads me finally to Donna Murch's paper, which moves forward in time, focusing more on the classic neoliberal moment of the 1980s and 1990s, looking at the ways in which local police officials with substantial federal support militarized and then used their military power to criminalize large segments of the Black and Latino population, and also along the way developed all sorts of new coercive tactics, surveillance, mass arrests, property forfeiture, to control the menace of gangs. This is also, interestingly, a story of discourse, of how we create a language of of neoliberalism. The LA police are using the language of the militia, elite commando units. You could do a whole close reading, and I won't, but I could. It would be a lot of fun. A whole close reading of the acronyms and names that they use to describe their activities. They signal that this is war. And they're also using new military technologies, including what becomes ubiquitous in Los Angeles by the 1980s when I first visited there, when I stayed with someone who lived in a section that was still very much racially mixed and mostly working class, were helicopters flying over at night, which reminds one of being in Vietnam in the 1960s or 1970s, which leads me to the point of thinking about the ways in which going back to questions of territory and colony, how the development of these new technologies and strategies and a language of policing and control are coming at the very moment that the United States is involved and entangled with these projects overseas, particularly the war in Vietnam. It's no surprise that the first generation of new militarized policing is happening right in the middle of the Vietnam War, that responses to the riots are drawing from some of the same technologies that are being deployed overseas in Southeast Asia, and that folks are using such metaphors as the urban jungle and describing police elite units as the equivalent of the Green Berets going to fight crime, just like we're fighting the guerrillas in Southeast Asia. So I want to see a little bit of further development of this, to think about the ways that the police describe themselves in military terms, but also saw the community in terms of territorial occupation. I think that's a theme that runs through much of this neoliberal moment, is occupation. Murch's discussion of anti-gang discourse and strategy is really rich and very revealing. She talks about the gangs as trash. I hear here echoes of, or maybe a foreshadowing of, Sarkozy's racaille, that needed to be removed from the city's streets to protect the territory. And this also points to one of the most astonishing facts in this article, that in 1992, the Los Angeles sheriff found that 47% of all African-American men in LA County between the ages of 21 and 24 were gang members, an extraordinary figure that surely reflects a very peculiar construction of what it meant to be gang members and a criminalization of everyday activities by African-Americans. One of the most interesting and important insights in this paper goes onto this gang issue is the way that African-American class politics in the era of neoliberalism proved to be integral to the drug wars in Los Angeles. And this is, I think, an area that needs more insight as well, because we see the emergence of an increasingly politically empowered African-American middle class, the same one that produces Barack Obama in Oakland and Hyde Park, and Valerie Jarrett, who's a player in the Obama administration, central in the Obama administration, but also walks across Mary Petillo's pages. And we need to think in some ways about the ways in which class politics among African-Americans helps for the inscription of these policies in urban space. Perhaps, though, unlike Patillo or Tissot, Donna Murch ends her paper optimistically. She focuses on those activists who fought against neoliberalism and demanded funding to avert the crisis and argued that the crime problem was a public health problem. And here we can see perhaps a little light of hope that neoliberalism contains within it the seeds of its own destruction, even if those seeds haven't been fertilized and haven't really grown into very much yet. Perhaps some of the organizations that are responsible for neoliberalization might be responsible for undermining it as well. So finally, I just want to say make one last point that neoliberalization is a devolutionary project premised on the empowerment, in part at least premised on the empowerment of grassroots organizations, but these organizations have the will but not the capacity to address structural problems of inequality. They nominally empower, and we see this in Patillo's paper especially, where folks get representation, but the question is who gets represented. They offer nominal participation, but often at the cost of worsening rather than improving urban problems. Neoliberalism often takes a progressive guise, giving voice to groups that were marginal in the process of planning, but who often reinforce the process of neoliberalization. And finally, neoliberalism is a project of occupation and territorial control, of pioneer settling, of police disciplining, of military occupation, of renaissance, and the imposition of culture on space. Together, in other words, all these papers, I think, offer us some new ways of thinking about both the chronology and the practice of neoliberalism in cities in our time. Thanks.
So I had one question. You were talking about in the urban planning strategies of the African-American population, you were talking about the powerful trend towards depoliticization and the power of the do-it-yourself discourse. And so I was wondering to what extent we also see counter-discourses and resistance towards this depoliticization trend.
Thanks for the question. And I definitely thought about that question when Tom did his summary and said that, you know, Donna's paper ends a little bit more optimistically. My paper definitely ended very pessimistically. And I started thinking when Tom said that, I have to stop being such a Debbie Downer. I have to start thinking maybe there, what is going on? So in the book from which this material comes, I have more tension in the politics of middle-class African Americans than was reflected here. I have this term called middle men and middle women, where they are often sometimes fighting to keep poor people out, to demolish public housing, to do the kind of anti-crime activism that Sylvie talked about in Boston that looks very similar to what whites were doing in Boston, middle-class blacks were doing in Chicago. So I have those examples. But at other times, they, for example, will insist that on new construction projects, African-Americans be hired, insist that black businesses get preferential treatment in trying to in coming to the neighborhood, insist on mortgage dollars coming to black neighborhoods. And so this middleman idea is about, at the same time, brokering resources for black neighborhoods and insisting on racial equality and representation, but at other times excluding what political scientist Kathy Cohen calls processes of secondary marginalization. So while blacks in general might be marginalized, processes of secondary marginalization are marginalizing groups within the black community. So in this case, it's poor African Americans, but in the case that Kathy Cohen studies, it's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered blacks, or people who use drugs, or any kinds of people that were marginalized within the black community. So in my larger work, I have a bit more balanced approach, but it never, I don't think, reaches the level that I think Donna is talking about, or that I think Lester Spence was calling for in his critique around actual political mobilization. The politics is always of a technical sort, and I think that distinction between politics and technical management or planning is really key. The kinds of, protest politics pretty much does not exist in the neighborhood that I studied. And I think in a lot of, short of what's going on now with the Black Lives Movement, I think that is this moment where we're having clear protest politics. But as Don and I have talked about earlier, there are definitely generational divides about what kind of politics, protest politics, the Black Lives Movement should take. And that has, I think, both generational and class manifestations. So I don't see, surely in the neighborhood that I've studied or much outside of the Black Lives Movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, the kind of political protest and political movements that are challenging this neoliberal management or technical term.
Bonjour, Julien Talpin. Merci tout d'abord pour la session que j'ai trouvée vraiment passionnante et très très cohérente en fait. J'avais une question pour Donna, mais qui peut aussi être probablement transversale pour les trois intervenants au fond sur la question de l'historicisation du néolibéralisme. Et la question, au fond, c'est est-ce que quand bien même on revient dans l'histoire et on revient en arrière, si le développement du néolibéralisme est forcément linéaire au fond. Et est-ce que, en vous écoutant, j'avais parfois un peu le sentiment que d'une histoire, d'une lente montée en puissance du néolibéralisme qui se ferait de façon très linéaire, alors que cette histoire est peut-être plus chaotique, précisément au gré des luttes politiques et des rapports de force entre différents acteurs. Et ma question était précisément plutôt pour Donna, sur parce que je connais assez bien Los Angeles, et au fond, il y a tout un discours à Los Angeles, en tout cas, d'un tournant à partir des années 2000, alors je ne sais pas si votre enquête va jusque-là, d'un tournant dans les politiques carcérales et les politiques policières, suite à l'élection du nouveau maire au milieu des années 2000, Villaraigosa, suite à un certain nombre de poursuites judiciaires menées notamment par Connie Rice. Donc est-ce que ces nouvelles pratiques policières et la façon de travailler avec les gangs, sur les gangs, ou de lutter contre les gangs, s'inscrit au fond dans cette lente montée en puissance du mouvement néolibéral ou constitue une inflexion? De la même façon, encore plus récemment, après pareil, c'est pas forcément dans votre enquête historique, mais le passage récent de la proposition de référendum 47, Prop 47, qui a été gagnée précisément par une mobilisation de mouvements sociaux comme ceux que vous évoquiez tout à l'heure, comme Community Coalition, pourrait être perçu comme un contre-coup à la politique de criminalisation des minorités, puisque cette proposition se traduit par une décriminalisation d'un certain nombre de comportements, et c'est d'ailleurs traduit depuis le début de l'année par un baisse de la population carcérale en Californie, qui est une première depuis plusieurs décennies. Et donc, voilà, est-ce que l'histoire de ce tournant néolibéral est forcément linéaire? Ou est-ce qu'au gré précisément des luttes des mouvements sociaux que vous évoquez également, des contre-coups peuvent être aperçus? Et est-ce que ce qu'on a aperçu dans les années 2000, voire encore plus récemment en Californie avec la Prop 30 et Prop 47, constitue une inflexion ou à l'inverse s'inscrivent dans cette montée en puissance néolibérale? Voilà, merci.
Thank you very much for that question. Just to repeat the question for people, it focused on questions of is neoliberalism a constant development? Is it something that we can trace a linear evolution? Or do we look at it as something more disparate and fractured and shifting according to the political actors? And then he asked about the post-2000 period that we're seeing the passage of Proposition 47, which was a decarceration proposition, in the attempt to, largely because of a sense of fiscal crisis and the cost of the carceral state, to roll back imprisonment. It's after my period, but I've been living in LA, so I can speak to it a little bit, and also to the analysis of prison abolitionists of Proposition 47, who were very, very critical of it. And this speaks also to something that Mary said about Black Lives Matter movement. So I'm going to go back in time a little bit and talk about the neoliberalism, the evolution, and also I'm happy to hear that the paper ended on a relatively happy note, because I usually don't feel happy about it. It's really, what happened in LA is a devastating story. One thing that's missing from this paper, which is the real reason why it's so optimistic, is that, speaking directly to Tom's point about the intersection with foreign policy, both in the creation of SWAT. And I have another piece that I wrote called The Many Meanings of Watts that talks about directly that cross-fertilization between Vietnam and counterinsurgency strategy. So elsewhere I've written about that more, and so I didn't get a chance to talk about it, but I do think it's absolutely central. But another piece of foreign policy that intersects with this is, of course, the wars in Central America. So a very important factor in mobilizing the Black population in Los Angeles is actually in 1996, because you have the revelations of the journalist Gary Webb about the involvement of the CIA in drug trafficking. And this it absolutely ignited the Black community, and it brought together many of the more conservative actors into an absolute opposition to the war on drugs, because the state is seen as both the agent of this illegal economy that's so destructive of the crack crisis, and also providing the rationale for punishment. So there's actually a real story of mobilization about 4 years later, and that organization that I talked about, CAPA, is at the center of that. And they really force Maxine Waters to have hearings about the role of the CIA in crack distribution. And there, you might, if you're interested in this, you can go on the web and see footage. The head of the CIA, John Deutsch, comes to Los Angeles, and there's a public meeting with 2,500 people there who shout him down, and he's fired 2 weeks later. So there is a direct intervention in foreign policy that's very profound. So I think that there are many different both domestic and international dimensions to talking about the war on drugs. So in that sense, trying to link some of that, the warfare state, the global warfare state, to the domestic politics of the war on drugs, both in terms of symbolism, but also actual policy. So in thinking about post-2000, I think that right now there's kind of a new potential coalition that's emerging, both from conservative Republicans and longtime prison activists over decarceration. Many of the scholars have been very critical of it. There was recently a piece published by Marie Gottschalk talking about the limitations of these decarceration approaches. And her argument is that, yes, structural causes of crime are very important and they need to be addressed, these liberal questions about a redistributive state. But she says, no, there are actual measures that we can take to dismantle the incarceration state, and that can be done immediately versus long-term structural causes. But I think the analysis that I've heard that I find very compelling is actually from some of the leaders in Black Lives Matter. And they talk about non-reformist reforms versus reformist reforms. For whatever reason, this movement uses very, very complicated language. It's really interesting. I think that there's been a whole migration of some of even ideas of post-structuralism into the movement. You know, Afro-pessimism and a whole kind of literature on identity is really crucial to this movement. And it looks and sounds entirely different from the Black Power movement. But non-reformist reforms versus reformist reforms. And the argument is that you should only pass reforms that don't hurt. So the opposition to Proposition 47 is that while it allows for the release of nonviolent offenders, the danger is that it, first of all, where the money goes for the money that's saved in decarceration, I think 75% to 80% is refunneled back into the CDC. And then the second issue is, if that functions as a safety valve for the carceral state, what about violent offenders? What about people that don't fall into these categories that are seen as innocent victims or relatively, I hate to use this language, but a relatively minimal threat to the public. So there was a lot of opposition, I'd say, from prison abolitionists to Prop 47.
Okay. I'll try to bring it back to pessimism. And I actually was glad that Tom brought up Daniel Rogers' caution, because I share that view that neoliberalism is one of these kind of words that often function as a somewhat of an empty signifier in conversations and obscures more than it reveals, and that it's up to historians to sort of bring more grounding, and sociologists and others. And I actually like, I don't know how many people have read Neil Brenner's work, particularly his article on actually existing neoliberalism. I think it's a really good sort of way to think about the kind of, you know, sort of embodied emplacements of neoliberalism, how it actually sort of functions and winds itself out in actual practices by people in everyday life. But the pessimistic view I want to come back to is really to shift back the conversation to race, because there's a lot of, sometimes we can get into this kind of process where we talk about the relationship of race and neoliberalism almost as if race is a kind of epiphenomenal category, right? That capitalism somehow produces these racial relationships. But, well, of course, racism and white supremacy are deep planks in the American character, you know, the American political culture, and they long predates capitalism. It long predates the kinds of politics that we have now. And So I wanted to sort of ask all of you to sort of reflect a bit more on race as this kind of deep category of experience in American culture, because neoliberalism is just, you know, maybe one emergent recent phenomenon in which race, it plays all sorts of dramatic roles, but it's been doing that for, you know, 300, 400 years, whatever, you know, you get the idea. So maybe reflect on that a little bit. I think there's a lot to more to say about that, and also the other side of that is also to sort of reflect on the idea. And I'm trying to sort of be general here, but you know, the idea of neoliberalism as reflective of another part of the American culture, which is very profound and deep, which is the very private nature of American society. It's a very private culture in a lot of ways. Neoliberalism is, as many of you in your very richly detailed papers have shown us, it's not something that's imposed from the top down. It emerges out of really, truly felt needs and urges and desires and interests among broad classes of people for certain kinds of, experiences in life, right? And part of that is the experience of privatism, the family, all these things that are rooted in American culture and society that both blacks and whites alike often aspire to. They're not somehow distinct, between different groups. So just a few things to sort of reflect on, maybe.
We think of neoliberalism as some kind of break in the early 1970s, but rather thinking about intensification might be a better way to think about it. And so I think you're exactly right with this is not the creation of entrepreneurial subjectivities, for example. Those have been with us, and in some respects, you're right, in a very American way, definitely. For example, the point that I make about, blacks and Latinos are now supposed to fix their own communities, that's not new either. Surely even the model cities idea was, here, we'll give you some resources, now fix your own communities. So I agree that there are lots of continuities. And in some respects, I think those continuities exist because the term neoliberalism just comes from liberal. And so if we think about Adam Smith, it's as if we think Adam Smith at some point went to sleep for a couple of decades or maybe a century in the US. And then now supposedly we've woken him up. And I think the point is that he never went to sleep. And so we've put neo in front of liberalism, but I think the word itself illustrates those continuities. I think it's a challenging periodization, and that's why I like the intensification ideas.
Thank you. I really enjoyed all the papers and the ideas that were expressed. I've been living in Washington, D.C. for 40 years, and really what you say resonates so much with what I have experienced. So now you have in Washington, D.C., of course, the black elite, quote unquote. But what is interesting is that the displaced people are not only poor people, that the so-called black elite was encouraged to leave their old historic homes that they inherited from their parents, grandparents, etc., to go to certain areas where they would have more space. Mm-hmm. More modern housing. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of ghettoized new elite living in Prince George's County, for instance, in Mitchellville, etc. So I wanted to know if in Boston or in Chicago the same thing happened, and what happened with the displaced population, who they were, where they went, etc. Then for Donna, I have a question also. There is that image of gangs in Los Angeles. I want to know if there are so many gangs in Los Angeles in reality, or is it an image that has been forged, and if so, why? And then you use the term, Sylvie, gentrificateur, which I thought was interesting in French, because I had never heard it in French before. Gentrificateur. So what term do you give to the people that have been displaced by the gentrificateur in French? And then my last question for Thomas and the new topography of gentrified neighborhoods with dog parks. We have that in Washington, D.C. too. And I would like to know why dogs. I mean, they want to have diversity, but maybe diversity is not safe. You need a dog. So anyway, those are my questions.
Well, I'll start. Mitchellville in Prince George's County in Washington, D.C. is definitely something that has been documented in cities across the country. In about 2010 was the first time that the African-American population became majority suburban. The white population has been majority suburban since about 1960. Latino and Asian population was majority suburban by about between the 1990s and 2000s. And by 2010, the black population now became majority suburban. And what's fascinating about that is the black population becomes majority suburban just as at the moment when also now suburbs are in decline. and so similar to the fact that the Great Migration, when blacks moved from the South to the North, just at the tail end of the Industrial Revolution, they caught some of it in some of the bigger cities, but soon after, Detroit and Cleveland and Chicago and Buffalo and all of the destinations were in economic decline when blacks came. That's a similar story that now we see with the suburbanization. So the what that will mean in terms of the ability to access good schools and jobs and those kinds of things, I think it's not a good omen for what that will mean. The one thing that's I'd be curious maybe during the break to talk to anybody about, you mentioned the black elite in places like Washington, and I've talked about them in Chicago, and I would be curious about if there is a group that plays that role here in Paris or in France. Is there some group that is managing these kinds of neighborhood planning processes, that are the voices, that are the people doing the technical part? And do they similarly have this sometimes speaking for the community, sometimes doing things that might marginalize the community or even displace or even exclude the community that they are meant to represent? So that's a question for everybody, maybe during the break.
Yes, there are lots of gangs in Los Angeles. They're not an invention. I think that the nature of spatial organization in Los Angeles lent itself to the formation of these, sometimes they're called in other parts of the country, cliques, clubs, or groups. The initial black gangs in Los Angeles were largely formed in areas where black neighborhoods bordered on white neighborhoods, where you saw white gangs that were engaging in racial, of their own informal racial policing, so trying to keep people out of their neighborhoods. So there's a long prehistory of gangs in Mexican America, among Mexican Americans and other immigrant groups. So this is a real social formation. Writing the history of gangs is very difficult because it is so difficult to disentangle the representations and ideology of what gangs are from the real social phenomena and then to gain access to them. Because I'm a historian, you know, the disciplinary approach shapes how you, what kind of documentation you use. But many of the historians, we have to rely on ethnographies that have been done of the formation of gangs and gang membership. And one thing I would say about that is there's a real problem of social prurience about gangs. Because gangs have been so celebrated and demonized, depending on the time period, you know, in many ways white gangs, like the ones from Boston, became iconic, you know, they're celebrated by, as kind of a, you know, machismo, masculinist culture of white ethnics, while the so-called gangs of blacks and Latinos have really been seen as urban blight and danger. So there is a difficulty in gaining access. And I think the problem of prurience and representing gangs is difficult. When I started out my project, I wanted to write it actually more about gangs and crack. And what I found is that the carceral state is so deep and profound in Los Angeles. It's very difficult to separate any aspect of what I've talked about, the war on gangs, from many of the sources that we get on gangs, which come from largely from criminologists and ethnographers. So still more is to be said and to be researched on gangs. There are some researchers in Los Angeles and kind of popular histories that are written by former gang members themselves. There's a wonderful website called streetgangs.com, and it's covered with all kinds of advertising. You have to wade through the pop-up menus. But it has amazing documentation, videos that have been done from gangs in different neighborhoods that will really give you short interviews where people speak for themselves. A quick thing I wanted to say about black class politics, and that goes back also to the question about Los Angeles, is that in LA, the neighborhood that has the largest number, the greatest concentration of black populations is View Park, which is a relatively wealthy neighborhood. So Los Angeles, I think, is very different than other cities. I was thinking immediately of the comparison with Bed-Stuy in New York, where the core black concentration is actually in wealthier neighborhoods. Whereas you see in South Central, already by 1990, South Central is 40% Latino, Hispanic, largely Mexican and Salvadoran. So the density of black middle class formation in LA, I think, is really important. I think they have a very strong voice. Obviously, much of the war on drugs and war on gangs is presided over by a black mayor. And to go back to the Connie Rice question, I just had to add this anecdote. When Connie Rice published her autobiography, you know, the beginning of her connection with LAPD was writing a major report on the Rampart scandal, which was a terrible scandal in which one of these units that I talked about, the crash unit, had been setting up people with drugs, had been involved in all this illegal activity. That's how Connie Rice, who is the cousin of Condoleezza Rice, she was hired as a consultant to do the report on the Rampart scandal. She developed such a close relationship with the LAPD that when she published her autobiography, it was held in the Parker Center downtown, and she even has a parking space. So that process of incorporation and connection to law enforcement, and she originally had been the lawyer prosecuting police brutality for the NAACP. So LA is really, despite my presentation of Kappa and the grassroots organizations, some of the powerful, particularly the NAACP, which may not be a surprise given recent events, comes out looking really, really bad.
Alors peut-être que quelques éléments, puis en guise de conclusion aussi de la séance, peut-être aussi pour revenir sur les commentaires de Tom qui, je trouve, vont vraiment avancer le débat sur la question. En fait, quand Andrew m'a proposé de participer à cette conférence donc sur la ville néolibérale, j'étais assez mal à l'aise parce que, en fait, je m'étais jamais vraiment confrontée à ce concept. J'avais même plutôt laissé de côté puisqu'il n'est pas non plus extrêmement présent en France, en tout cas beaucoup moins, je crois, que dans la sphère universitaire américaine. Et du coup, bon, voilà, ça m'a obligé à préciser un peu les choses. Ce que j'avais essayé de faire aussi, ce que j'avais un peu, je m'étais sentie obligée de faire quand j'ai réécrit en fait la conclusion du livre pour la traduction américaine. Là, je me suis sentie un peu plus obligée de m'engager plus avec ces débats. Et c'est à cette occasion-là que je suis allée, pas retrouver, mais j'ai mis en avant cette référence à Evie Thompson, qui peut paraître un petit peu curieuse quand on travaille sur la gentrification, mais qui, en fait, me permettait aussi de prendre mes distances par rapport à toute une littérature qui me semblait insatisfaisante pour rendre compte de la gentrification, comme si la gentrification, en fait, résultait soit d'une espèce d'intention comme ça venant d'en haut, ou au contraire d'ailleurs, ou en même temps, d'ailleurs ça peut être présent, comme une sorte de reflet des forces aveugles du marché. Et du coup, Evie Thompson me permettait de déplacer le regard par rapport à des lectures très économicistes et de revenir sur cette question de construction de classe sociale, même si au départ du projet, plus que Evie Thompson, ce qui était vraiment... ce qui m'a permis aussi de formuler la question, c'était plus des références aussi à Bourdieu. Mais bon, je vais pas revenir sur ça. Mais peut-être en guise de conclusion sur ce débat aussi entre pessimisme et optimisme, où je vais adopter une sorte de position de juste milieu, en guise de conclusion, et pour revenir à la question de Tom qui m'invite à préciser un peu ses modalités de surveillance, en fait, de policing donc, du quartier, Un des épisodes auxquels j'ai pu assister lors de mon enquête, c'est en fait l'intervention de ces habitants très mobilisés dans ces actions locales au moment d'un projet d'achat par un foyer de personnes sans logis, hein, de deux maisons, de deux brownstones, pour accueillir en fait ces personnes ayant suivi tout un programme de réinsertion, etc. Et en fait, la vente à cette association, à ce foyer de sans-logis, a suscité une énorme mobilisation, notamment de propriétaires de la rue, et une contre-mobilisation en fait des gens que moi j'étudiais déjà depuis plusieurs années, au nom de la diversité. C'est-à-dire qu'ils ont pris la défense de ce projet d'achat de ces deux maisons pour accueillir des anciennes personnes qui étaient à la rue, au nom de la diversité. Ils l'ont fait, ceci dit, en intervenant dans le projet et en prônant la présence de personnes de niveau de revenus intermédiaires. En disant, en fait, ça ne peut marcher que si on a aussi dans ces immeubles, pas seulement, en gros, des pauvres, mais aussi des classes moyennes. Donc, une diversité. Hein. Donc, ça illustre bien, en fait, ce que j'appelle une sorte de gouvernement de la diversité, qui, pour revenir à cette question d'optimiste ou pessimiste, on pourrait dire est ni régressif ni progressiste. En fait, c'est une sorte de mélange d'inclusion et d'exclusion qui rompt avec des formes de ségrégation raciale qui passent par l'éloignement spatial, puisque là, l'idée, c'est d'organiser dans la proximité des inégalités sociales et raciales. Donc, pour moi, c'est quelque chose d'assez nouveau. On pourrait dire, est-ce que c'est plus progressiste, moins progressiste? En fait, j'en sais rien. C'est peut-être pas, même pas à moi de le dire et pas aux sociologues de le dire. Mais les barrières sociales sont à la fois recomposées et maintenues par cette manière, justement, d'organiser spatialement et en la valorisant, ce qui est aussi nouveau dans le sens où ça implique une certaine reconnaissance d'une égale dignité des autres, qui sont tout de même maintenus à des places subordonnées dans un même environnement spatial. Voilà. Bon, j'aurais d'autres choses à dire, mais je pense qu'il est temps de...